Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. An unusual program this time because, unlike I think every previous occasion, this is one where I cannot start with a message from Sheldon Idle. But for some reason there isn't one this week, so I'm hoping there will be one for the following week. It does of course mean that I have much more time for the other subjects that I'm bringing up. As it happens, I do have a few more general news items than usual. And on the UFO subject, I have... Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. Unlike most programs, I cannot start this one with my usual message from Sheldon Idle. That is one on behalf of the Galactic Federation. So that does give me more time for the other topics I have. And as it happens, I have a few more items on the question of general news. And on the UFO subject, I have seven different cases of healing that is associated with UFOs. That will allow me to end up the program with one of my favourite other messages of a spiritual nature, an older one that has come through Rona Herman by Archangel Michael. And then, with whatever time is left after that, I'll find a few more similar messages. So I'll start with what I call the general news. This week, from Washington, through CNN, this happened on Tuesday, May the 22nd. There was a report that the Congressional Democrats planned to send President Bush a war spending bill without a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. And this was according to two Democrats of the leadership side, and they informed CNN of this fact. Apparently, earlier this month, Bush vetoed a war spending bill passed by the Democratic Congress and included a timetable for withdrawal. And the president has insisted that he will not sign any bill that includes such a provision. The bill is expected to include benchmarks that the Iraqi government would have to achieve. And the bill is also expected to require the president to provide numerous reports to Congress before August 2007 on the Iraqi government progress. So the aide said, if the Iraqi government fails to meet the benchmarks, the aide said reconstruction funds could be cut. The bill may also allow the president to waive the penalties for failing to reach the benchmarks if he feels they are necessary. White House spokesman Tony Snow Tuesday declined to comment on the proposals. So there we are. This one that we hope would include the withdrawal timetable seems to be dropped from the war spending bill. So that report came from the website CNN.com. Now, hot off the press, as they say, I had an email just a short time ago that was related to a report by Jerome Causey of World Net Daily, and it is an exclusive commentary, which was posted on May the 23rd. It's an interesting one, headed Bush Makes Power Grab, and I'll read it follows. President Bush, without so much as issuing a press statement, on May the 9th signed a directive that granted merely authorial powers to the Office of the President in the event of a national emergency led by the President. The National Security and Homeland Security Presidential Directive, with the dual designation of NSC Leader 1 as a National Presidential Directive, NSC Leader 20, also as a Presidential Directive, establishes under the Office of the President a new National Continuity Coordinator. The job, as the document describes, is to make plans for the national essential functions of all federal, state, local, territorial, and tribal governments, as well as private sector, organizations to continue functioning under the President's directives in the event of a national emergency. Directive loosely defines catastrophic emergency as any incident, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage or disruption, severely affecting the US population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. When the President determines a catastrophic emergency has occurred, the President can take over all government functions and direct all private sector activities to ensure we will emerge from. The directive loosely defines catastrophic emergency as any incident, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage or disruption, severely affecting the US population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. When the President determines a catastrophic emergency has occurred, the President can take over all government functions and direct all private sector activities to ensure we will emerge from the emergency with an enduring constitutional government. Translated into layman's terms, when the President determines a national emergency has occurred, the President can declare to the office of the presidency powers usually assumed by dictators to direct any and all government and business activities until the emergency is declared over. Ironically, the directive sees no contradiction in the assumption of dictatorial powers by the President with the goal of maintaining constitutional continuity for an emergency. The directive specifies that the assistant to the President for the Homeland Security, who is a White House staff member in the executive office of the President, who also chairs the Homeland Security Council, should, under the National Emergency Act, make no attempt to reconcile the powers created there for the National Continuity Coordinator, who is currently the assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, who is Francis Freydos Townsend. Townsend spent 13 years at the Justice Department before moving to the U.S. Coast Guard, where she served as Assistant Commandant for Intelligence. The Congressional Research Service study notes that under the National Emergency Act, the President may seize property, organize and control means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a variety of ways, control the lives of United States citizens. And there I will end my extract from this World Net Daily report, because I think the last few comments I have made actually size up what is taking place, and I think it's not an unknown fact that George Bush would like to find reason to create a situation where martial law can be declared. So we wait and see how far he goes to achieve that. My next report here comes from the 24th of May, and the group Amnesty has apparently said yesterday that the United States was trampling on human rights and using the world as a giant battlefield in its war on terror, and that Washington was also guilty of breathtakingly shameless doublespeak, claiming to be promoting human rights, while at the same time brazenly flouting international law. And this is what the London-based group Amnesty International claimed in its 2007 annual report. A short comment on the US by Amnesty International. Now I move on to something that's being circulated on the internet, and it's just simply a call for people to make a live vote as to whether President George W. Bush should be impeached. And the point I wanted to make here was that so far there has been an indication that the results are overwhelming, that 88%, that is 478,217 responses, were in favour of impeachment taking place. If you want to know more about that or place a vote yourself, you can go to the very excellent website, rumormillnews.com, and you'll find all the information there. Now, over many years, there's been a lot of talk about Osama bin Laden. I now come to a short report about Osama bin Laden. As we know, for quite a number of years, he has been alleged to have died. And there was a period of time when they were chasing him. I think it was out of Afghanistan, in Pakistan. And they believed that they had tracked him down to some caves, which I believe were pummeled with these type of deep bunker bombs. And the assumption was that they had probably killed him in those attacks. Subsequently, we've had one or two rather shaky-looking videos of Osama bin Laden allegedly making short speeches. And I recall on one of them, they took a reading of the speech pattern, and they were pretty certain that it was not actually Osama bin Laden who was making that particular video. Now, this report, which comes from the website whatreallyhappened.com, does state that Osama bin Laden is dead, and says that the news first came from sources in Afghanistan and Pakistan almost 6 months ago, that the fugitive died in December 2001 and was buried in the mountains of southeast Afghanistan. And Pakistan's president, Pervez Musharraf, echoed the information. They say that the remnants of Osama's gang, however, have mostly stayed silent, either to keep Osama's ghost alive or because they have no means of communication. And the comment is made that with an ego the size of Mount Everest, Osama bin Laden would not have or could not have remained silent for so long if he was still alive. He always liked to take credit even for things he had nothing to do with. Would he remain silent for 9 months and not trumpet his own survival? And that comment came from the New York Times on July 11, 2002. So there we are. Again, if you want to read a bit more about that, go to the site whatreallyhappened.com and you'll find some more information on that. Another report, this time from Paul Joseph Watson. I'm trying to see very quickly who he writes for. But I can't actually see it here. It's not on the female, I have, which is rather a shame. It's about the 9/11 debunkers. And the fact that they're hiding from slam dunk evidence of controlled demolition. This is an interesting report, as I've often said. 9/11 won't go away. And the interesting thing here is that it highlights new evidence regarding the controlled demolition. And I read as follows. Electron microscopic analysis of steel spheres from WTC sites proves collapse of twin towers was an act of deliberate arson. And Professor Stephen Jones presented brand new, compelling evidence for the controlled demolition of the Twin Towers and WTC-7 recently. But the 9/11 debunkers and the corporate media are loath to tackle it because it represents a slam dunk on proving the collapse of the buildings was a deliberate act of arson. During a talk at the Rebuilding America's Senses event at the University of Texas last month, Jones laid out facts about steel samples recovered from the WTC site that popular mechanics dare not even attempt to debate. Debunkers are scared to even get near this information because the science behind it fundamentally contradicts the official story of what happened on 9/11. Big Lab experiments in which he attempted to replicate NIST's conclusion that the lava-like orange material flowing out of the South Tower is aluminium from Flight 175, the plane that hit the building. Jones clearly documents the fact that liquid aluminium is silver and not orange, as is seen in the video of the South Tower. Therefore, the material cannot be aluminium. Jones then explains that the material is in fact a compound that can cut through steel, like a hot knife through butter. Thermite with sulfur added to make thermate. The crux of the fresh evidence revolves around newly uncovered globules, or spheres, that were discovered at the WTC site that Professor Jones was able to obtain and run an electron microscope analysis on it. The spheres contained iron and aluminium, which would be expected in any steel sample, but also sulfur, which is a byproduct of thermate. So having moved from a hypothesis that thermate was used to bring down towers from using video footage and debunking the aluminium explanation of NIST, Jones now has empirical scientific proof undertaken under laboratory conditions that thermate was indeed used as an artificial explosive at the World Trade Center. It has now been proven beyond a shadow of doubt that the collapse of the Twin Towers in WT7 was an act of deliberate arson and not as the result of fires from crushing plane. There we are. That isn't a complete report, but that is really the important aspects of it. You'll probably be aware that about a week ago, former President Carter said that President Bush's administration is the worst in history. In international relations and White House's policy of preemptive war and its Middle East diplomacy. Criticism from Carter, which a biographer said is unprecedented for the 39th president, also took aim at Bush's environmental policies and the administration's quite disturbing faith-based initiative funding. Quote, I think as far as the adverse impact on the nation around the world, this administration's been the worst in history, Carter told the Arkansas Democratic Gazette in a story that appeared in the newspapers Saturday edition. The overt reversal of America's basic values as expressed by previous administrations, including those of George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and others, has been the most disturbing to me. Now, that wasn't a full report, but you may not know that within the last day or two, Carter had to eat humble pie, in a manner of speaking, and he had to try and gloss over his statements by saying that they had been misinterpreted. But one can only assume that there was some hot air flowing between him and other interested parties who were obviously livid at the fact that he made those public statements, that he's doing his best to, I suppose, cover his track. Now, move on now to a report by Greg Pallas, who is on the redblog.com website, and he calls this The Goods on Goodling and the Keys of the Kingdom. And this came out yesterday, and it relates to the no longer missing Rove emails revealing the cagey scheme to steal the 2008 election. Now, it reads that this moniker revealed something hotter, much hotter, than a stained blue dress. In her opening testimony yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee, Monica Goodling, the blondling underling to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and Department of Justice liaison for the White House, dropped the big one. And the committee members didn't even know it. Goodling testified that Gonzalez Chief of Staff Carl Sampson perjured himself, lying to the committee in earlier testimony. The lie, Sampson denied Monica had told him about Tim Griffin's involvement in caging voters in 2004. The perplexed committee members hadn't a clue and asked no substantive questions about it thereafter. Carl Rove is still smiling. If the members had gotten a clue and asked the right question, they would have found the keys of the kingdom they thought they were looking for. They dangled right in front of their perplexed faces. The keys, using the missing emails, a missing link, could send Griffin and his boss Rogue to the slammer for a long, long time. But what's caging, and why is it such a dreadful secret that Lysasson put his license to practice and his freedom on the line to cover Tim Griffin's involvement in it? And the writer here comes back and says, because it's a felony, and a big one. The report goes on to say, our BBC team broke the story at the top of the nightly news everywhere on the planet except the USA, only because American news networks simply refused to cover this evidence of the electoral coup d'etat that chose our president in 2004. Here's how the caging work, and along with Griffin's thoughtful emails themselves, you'll understand it in no time. The Bush-Cheney operatives send hundreds of thousands of letters marked "Do not forward" to voters hard. Letters returned, which are called cage, were used. The Bush-Cheney operatives send hundreds of thousands of letters marked "Do not forward" to voters hard. Letters returned, which are referred to as cage, were used as evidence to block these voters, these voters' rights, cast a ballot on grounds they were registered at voting addresses. There were the evil fakers, homeless men, students on vacation, and you could go to loveless American soldiers, or yeah, just the American voters. Why weren't these African American voters home when the Republican voters arrived? Homeless men were on park benches, students were on vacation, and soldiers were overseas. So today, I lose your vote, mission accomplished. How do I know? I have the caging list. I have them because they are attached to the email of Rowling's list can't be found. I have the emails, 500 of them, sent to our team at BBC after the robots accidentally sent them to a web domain owned by our friend John Wooden. Here's what you need to know, and the committee would have discovered if only they had asked. 1. Caging voters is a crime, a go-to-jail felony. 2. Griffin wasn't involved in the caging. Miss Goodling, Griffin, Rose's right-hand man, was directing the illegal purge and challenge campaign. The writer says, how do I know? It's in the email I got, thanks. And it's posted above. 3. On December the 7th, the raging caging Griffin's name on Rose's personal demand, U.S. attorney for a current offensive. 33 then become prosecuted. The committee will submit to their army planetary mission and actually pay for that saving it because the U.S. says that it comes. That's because as Griffin wrote to Goodling in another WA6 of this year, their staging operation only made the news on the data, passed it open, Griffin did by that viciously bored and very palace. There's no pride in this. Our BBC team wrote the story of the sovereign Matthew News, except the USA, only because the news network simply refused to cover this evidence of the electoral coup d'etat that chose our president in 2004. And now, not bothering to understand the astonishing revelation in Goodling's confessional, they're missing the real story behind the firing of the US attorneys. It's not about removing prosecutors of Donald Bush. It's about replacing those who refused to aid their vote in 2004 with those prepared to burglary the game in 2008. Now that they see the paint right off, the clock is ticking, ladies and gentlemen. They are. Very amazing report, one that you might be hearing for the first time. So if you want to read the whole report and see copies I have of the email that we're talking about, you go to bradblog.com and you'll find all the information there. Now, Keith Olbermann has been on some of the videos on YouTube He's been talking about the way the Iraqi government has failed the UN on Iraq, and he made the point on the MSNBC countdown on Wednesday, the 23rd of May. And I'd like to read some of the items that he spoke about, not many. But he said, few men or women elected in our history, whether exclusive or, I beg your pardon, whether executive or legislative, state or national, have been sent into office with a mandate more obvious, nor instructions more clear. Now, he's talking about the Democrats who were recently put into power. And he's saying that the instructions to them were clear: get us out of Iraq. He's saying that after 6 months of preparation and execution, half a year, gathering the strands of public support, translating into action the collective will of nearly 70% of Americans who reject this war of lies, the Democrats have only managed this. And he gives the following. The Democratic leadership has surrendered to a president, if not the worst president, then easily the most selfish in our history, who has his own people and usually without military personnel, hostages who did afternoon demand that the Democrats give the troops their money. Secondly, the Democratic Hello everyone, I'm sorry about the repeated interruptions here, and I gather that there is also something with the line, and my voice is not coming over very clear. So we think in the circumstances it would be best to bring the program to a close here. So I'm awfully sorry about that. I'll keep more information ready for next week and try and integrate it with the new stuff. So I'll have to say thank you for bearing with me, but I will be back next Friday and hope that everything is in good order. Thank you very much. Bless you all.